Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for you, as usual. And you can't see it, but there's a huge smile on Jim Garrity's face this morning because his congressman is not running for re-election this year. His congressman is Virginia Democrat Jim Moran, and he's been there since getting first elected in 1990. He is an ardent supporter of pretty much every liberal position on every issue. But beyond that, he has also found his foot in his mouth many times, and it's to the point where it can't be by accident. He has had domestic violence issues. He's gotten into confrontation with, I think, like an 8-year-old kid in a playground. He blamed the Jews for America getting into war with Iraq. And so just a swell guy who won't be in public service, at least on the national level, after this year, Jim.
Your assessment of my smile is correct, Greg. Here's the thing. The fact that Jim Moran is liberal certainly doesn't endear him to you or I or a bunch of folks around here, but that in of itself is not really the problem. The problem is that he's a terrible person, and this is not just me, you know, throwing stuff around. I mean, and it's not just, you know, I did a long profile of him back in 2003 after the Jews are getting us into war comments. He's never been convicted of domestic violence. The police just keep getting called to his house and having to break up fights and stuff like that. Charges are never filed by them. You mentioned the 8-year-old boy at the playground. No, it was actually, you know, Greg, you're just blithely dismissive of the menace of 8-year-old carjackers, which is what Moran's claim was, which is why he was, you know, threatened the boy, carried the boy from a parking lot to a recreation center. No charges were filed, of course. When you're a congressman, these things tend to, you know, go away. I'm sure many, you know, listeners remember his charges of domestic battery or charges going up against his son for smashing his girlfriend's head against a dumpster. You know, there was also allegations of him getting various loans from people who had business before Congress. He's a bad, bad person. And everybody seemed to kind of avert their eyes because he was a Democratic congressman who, you know, brought home the district. When the Washington Post had to endorse him, he said, you know, Moran, a Democrat who has long represented the heavily Democratic 8th District, has embarrassed himself and his constituents with ill-considered comments in the past. But he's constituent-oriented, so, you know, like, I can't, you know, it was something amazing. It was like this, you know, the emperor has no clothes moment in which he was just an awful human being, abusive to people, and obviously when, you know, he'd go on MSNBC and say that, you know, Republicans are like the Klan, stuff that has really become almost standard for Democratic congressmen these days. But it was the domestic violence and you know, various temper outbursts and stuff like that that was troubling. His son is no winner either. So this is addition by subtraction. Like honestly, as bad as it is to be represented by a liberal Democrat, that's normal. I don't want a scandal-ridden, violent, abusive, bad person representing me. And everybody in the district trying to pretend like it's just, you know, politics as usual.
Yeah, I think the most depressing event came in 2004, which was right after he blamed the Jews for getting us into the war with Iraq. And you expect, you know, even if comments like that, it's a very left-leaning district, so, okay, he might beat a Republican. There was a very liberal Jewish Democrat who ran against him in the primary, yeah. And Moran still won 2-1 in the primary. So, district, this is kind of on you. Jim Garrity notwithstanding, of course, because, you know, you didn't vote for him. All right, on to martini number two now, and the Senate Intelligence Committee has released its long-awaited report on Benghazi and what led to it and different questions being answered. I think there are still going to be many more questions lingering out of this. The main conclusion, and this is the Fox News report, the report said the intelligence community provided ample strategic warning that security in eastern Libya was deteriorating and U.S. personnel were at risk. The report said multiple tripwires were cross-signaling security problems, and the State Department should have increased its security posture in response. So there's a lot of criticism of the State Department, DOD, intelligence sources for not doing more to build up for a potential threat that seemed to be emerging. It also said that the U.S. military command in Africa didn't even know about the CIA annex and didn't have the resources to defend the diplomatic compound in an emergency. At the same time, the report claims that the 6 CIA employees responded to the attack on the diplomatic compound. They neither asked permission to come to the aid of the diplomats nor were told to stand down. The committee found that the military response to the attacks was slow and hindered, but not purposely so. I've seen nothing in here, Jim, about the administration's constant reference to the video. So that obviously hangs out there as well. What's your thoughts on all this?
This is pretty darn depressing and not unbelievably shocking. I have to give a little bit of credit. We talk about so many things in the foreign policy realm, getting Benghazi and the, you know, most, you know, Democrats will insist, oh, this is Republicans and Fox News trying to stir up trouble where it was just a series of innocent mistakes. Well, this is a pretty damning report in just the bipartisan portions of it. And it basically says, look, there was more than ample warning of a deteriorating security situation in there. It mentions all the requests for assistance from Ambassador Stevens. It doesn't get that much into things like the talking points. It says there was no orders to stand down or any of that stuff with the rumors we've heard floating around in that. Nonetheless, it is kind of pointing out a rather troubling circumstance that we had people in some parts of Europe, but they weren't ready to go. They were going to have to go to other parts of Europe. There were planes, but the planes weren't loaded up with the right kind of ordnance. The U.S. military, which we are used to thinking of as the finest military fighting force in the whole history of the world, really appears kind of flat-footed and not really ready to respond to a crisis occurring in North Africa, which is not, you know, the far-off corners of the world. Lots of instances of miscommunications amongst the and lack of communication between the different branches of the State Department and the intelligence community and the military. Every bit is troubling. And, oh, by the way, finally in there, there's a point that apparently the State Department has its own Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and they've done no review of what happened in the year since the attacks, which is really bothersome and troublesome. And the committee itself says they find it disturbing. That's on Hillary. That's on John Kerry. That's on a State Department culture that has taken some changes to in response to what happened in Benghazi, but not certainly not all of them. And this, you know, lingering sense that there's been an effort to sweep this under the rug and move on beyond it as quickly as possible. I suppose the good news is that there's a certain amount of bipartisan agreement on this. It's worth noting the report doesn't mention Hillary, doesn't mention Susan Rice, doesn't mention Obama, doesn't aim very high in anything. But it's just a troubling setup and suggests the lack of organization and the slow-footedness and lack of just awareness of the threats in the region was every bit as bad as we suspected, Greg.
One more thing before we exit on this issue. This is from the Washington Post account of the report. The report also notes chillingly that the FBI's investigation into the attacks has been hampered inside Libya and that 15 people supporting the investigation or otherwise helpful to the United States have been killed in Benghazi since then. The report says it's unclear whether those killings were related to the investigation, which either means that they just don't have a good handle on it or it's so violent. Who knows?
Yeah, that might just be the Benghazi crime rate, Greg. When you have 15 of them, it certainly seems like people, you know, there has been an effort to attack those who are helping us with our investigation. Either just, you know, there's a violent culling of Benghazi every morning, or there's an effort to get people who are helping us, suggesting that, you know, basically we're not going to be able to get to the bottom of this because the Libyan government basically doesn't control Benghazi. And justice delayed, Greg. Justice denied.
Still no arrests, as far as I know. On to martini number three now, and this story broke yesterday. There has since been an apology, but the original report is that the Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon is less than thrilled with the performance of Secretary of State John Kerry. Kerry has spent a lot of time trying to push towards the Obama administration version of Middle East peace, and Yaalon is not all that keen on what exactly the Obama administration wants done. He says that Kerry is obsessive and messianic and dismissed Kerry's security plan as worthless. The quote that's getting a lot of attention is, "The only thing that might save us is if John Kerry wins the Nobel Prize and leaves us be." He has now, of course, issued a statement saying that we treasure our relationship with the United States, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, we're going to keep working with them in an effort to try and find some common ground here. But he points out also in the earlier comments that the Palestinians aren't even part of this at this point. It's just Kerry and the Obama administration trying to get concessions out of the Israelis. So while we keep hearing from the administration and from the mainstream press about all these fabulous inroads in the Middle East with the Iranian nuclear agreement and everything else, not exactly a lot of respect coming back towards us, it seems.
Yeah, and let's point out, for the interests of Israel, this is not a helpful statement from the defense minister. I'm sure Netanyahu has already, you know, called him onto the carpet, entirely separate of whether it's an accurate assessment or not. And I think that, you know, more and more folks in the Middle East think the idea of Kerry being on this idealistic messianic campaign to win the Nobel Peace Prize, well, it would explain a lot now, wouldn't it, Greg? Having said that, you know, it doesn't do Israel much good to be complaining publicly about John Kerry being a nut job and the Obama administration being, you know, completely oblivious to the threats in the region and being willing to play footsie with the Palestinians because they really, really want another Nobel Peace Prize and to have a big summit and, you know, be, have a legacy as a peacemaker and all that stuff. Now, seeing the Israeli defense minister say things like this, that basically he sees Kerry as acting kind of blindly and irrationally, well, that kind of helps explain a bunch about the Iranian deal, doesn't it, Greg? And it helps explain a bunch about Syria's going to give up its weapons and Russia's going to help make it work out and all that stuff. I mean, like, this is an administration that is really, since the second term began, and really under Kerry's tenure, been all out for summits and big, grandiose peace deals with folks who have proven themselves to be shady, shifty, unreliable, lying entities in the past. So what the defense minister is, you know, really asserting here is that U.S. foreign policy is no longer being conducted in the national interest. It is being conducted in the personal interest of the personal ambitions and hopes and delusions of grandeur of the Secretary of State and, by extension, the president. And so that is a crazy martini, Greg. I mean, this is a crazy, crazy world. Listeners should know that we had actually talked about the Twitter buzz that I'll be running for Congress as our other potential crazy martini. But honestly, goodness, we've reached the point where Secretary of State John Kerry is actually crazier than the idea of me running for Congress, which is, let's face it, pretty darn crazy.
Yes, yes, either one of us.
It's also not going to happen, by the way, lest I start any rumors.
There you go. Way to tamp down the speculation. But as the originator of the Kerry spot, Jim, do you have any advice for friends and foe alike who have to have conversations with him? And by conversation, I mean him going on and on and on. How do you deal with that best?
Very small earpieces where you can listen to something else. That always works very well. Also, if you really don't like John Kerry's position, the good news is if you wait a while, you'll eventually – look, I actually voted for it before I voted against it. So he'll eventually flip-flop in your direction and then just kind of grab him at that moment, and then you'll be okay. So that's my Kerry advice for the day.
Oh, man. That very good insight there. All right. Jim, fun as always. We'll talk to you on Friday.
See you Friday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. Jim will be out tomorrow, but there will be a three-martini lunch. Charlie Cook and I will be here, and then Jim and I will be here on Friday for the next three-martini lunch.